to us on WEFT Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois, 90.1 FM, streaming online at weft.org.
This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT Champaign, 90.1 on your FM dial. And it's the 17th, tomorrow Sunday when you will hear this, will be the 18th of July 2021. Okay, and today I'm going to talk to you about people who do interesting things, and it runs into our discussion of how we encourage people to be volunteers, to know inheritory, and then perhaps to become a CEO or an organizer of knowledge about a certain topic, whether it be music or art or prairies or rivers or what have you. We're short on those sorts of people, but I find it productive to be talking to people, and we have now organization of music on Friday night, and usually two bands right outside the door of WEFT, and people meet each other. They're so overjoyed to be back in action. One of those instances, it was, let me hold a moment. Got to keep my time here. And I was taking materials. Let me say that I have a lot to do with salvage, and often I'm left salvage that is interesting and productive, and it's sort of thought that I might have some way of redirecting it so that people could use it. It's not always the case. Sometimes it sits around and waits for a while, but I had theatrical closing and goodies that had been left with me for a while, and I delivered them. But I encountered someone who knew Market Street. They knew WEFT. They knew they had worked on the front windows of WEFT, and they had this history. His mother had a bookstore, and talking back and forth was enough to hook up your spirits, because you know that there are people around who have thoughts and ideas, and you have to have some way of sharing them, and music brings people together, and beer will bring people together too. So we have restaurants in the street, and we have some beer in the street, and we have music, and then we have people. And it's amazing. I watch a little gal who's probably no more than 2 feet high leading a dog on a leash. The dog was almost twice the size of the gal that was bringing the dog along. And the dog was very friendly, and if told to sit, it would sit, and it would enjoy. And so that sort of interaction is interesting. Somebody put up a sign which was a triangle, and so children who were small enough were willing to get in under the sign and hide. Some would dance, and even some of the WEFT people would dance, and some would surveil, looking over to see that beer didn't go out past the zone of where we were working. I just had a long conversation with Doug DeLong. He is an engineer, works with the state and regions, and he is doing prairie work as originally a Moultrie County engineer. He was organizing railroad white right-of-ways that I thought could be a prairie right-of-way, and now 20 years later it has grown, and he was calling me about a blue flower, which is, I know is a Veronica, and we got to be talking and figuring out how he might be able to sell prairie seed. It is not an awfully lucrative game, but it's interesting. And Prairie Moon, especially in southern Minnesota, has done very well. There's a limit to what you can do. There are just millions of bacteria and fungi out there. There are insects galore. There are birds that seem to have survived from the dinosaur era. There are people who volunteer, people who watch things. And so we talked about plants and their shade. So some plants would like to be under a forest. The wild ginger would like to do that. But other plants that come in spring will wilt away when the canopy comes over, but their roots will be there for next year. We talked about our only shrub, which is a Cenosis or New Jersey tea. And New Jersey tea is a shrub. It's a very low shrub, so you hardly recognize it as different from the perennial plants in the prairie. But it has this spread of about a 6 foot diameter of red roots. And when farmers were plowing for the first time, this root would block the plow and break the plow. So John Deere and others had to develop a stump jump plow that would, when it hit something like this or a stump where a tree had been taken out, the plow would move up and over and come back down again. So could that be a plant that Doug could plant and provide to seed companies? Can it be grown in the raw? Probably not, because especially if you have legumes, deer and other creatures are going to be very aware that you have plants that have nutriment. And if you're going to have a seed, for instance, you have to get there before the insects, because they know that there's proteinaceous material there. And you have to be lucky to have a soil that has nitrogen-fixing bacteria if you're going to deal with legumes. And the interaction between the roots of the plants is very little known. So if you want to join the preservation crowd and do interesting things with prairie, you have to know a little bit about the 110 broadleaf plants and about 6 grasses. And does it grow quickly? No. If you grow Indian grass, it can come in within the season. But if you're going to plant perennial plants, which most of the prairie is, then you're going to take 3-5 years before you have a decent little prairie that you can sort of see as a prairie. And then you probably have to wait till 10 years to get a more mature prairie. You may have to have a greenhouse to develop plants so that you can plant them out a little on the mature side so they don't get gobbled up by the deer. You have to socialize with the deer. Your land is probably not your land, it's their land, and that you're the invader rather than they. So do you have to put a fence around it? You have to, how do you organize this? It's a challenge. Well, I've been reading a book about Mayo Clinic. I have various people who have gone to Rochester, Minnesota to have an operation. And there's a story behind this. It goes back to probably about the 1830s when a guy named Mayo, his parents, I think, were working people, but he was working his way west. And he realized that he would have to have qualifications, and he was interested in becoming a doctor. The qualifications were very few and far between, but he would get to work with people, get some apprenticeship, and be able to put up a shingle as a doctor. He didn't do that very much because going west in the 1830s, 40s, 50s was a challenge. There were many doctors, many people who said they were doctors. Some of them were charlatans that weren't doctors, but were taking advantage of people who didn't have other medical answers. And he started to explore the Wisconsin and Minnesota and almost out to the Dakotas and figure out where he wanted to settle down. I'm not sure exactly why he ended up in Rochester, Minnesota. It's about probably 100 miles southeast of Minnesota, Minneapolis and St. Paul. And as I said, it was a smallish town. He liked that. He took on other jobs and occasionally would do something of a medical situation and solve it. So he developed a clientele, despite the fact that there were other doctors in the area. And he was rather good at this. First, most of the answers were chemicals. Whether you were willing to take a laxative or whether something you took, some food would improve your situation. Some inhalation would stop croup, for instance. But then there were people who broke legs or had infected wounds, and gradually Mr. Mayo Senior found ways of actually cutting out pieces of cancer, goiters. Women were having problems with growths that would get on their fallopian tubes or on their uterus. And in a cyst-like manner, they would grow and filled with water. So he got to drain those cysts, and he had no real operating theater. He would go to people's houses. It was a horse era, so he either had to ride a horse or go in a sulky. It was easier to do with the horse because the sulky could break down on the route, and there you were. There were no trains yet, so he couldn't hop on the train and go to somewhere. He was mostly working with local people, and that was friendly, and he could join different agencies in town and be a real person. He married someone who had similar thoughts, and eventually she got to be part of the Mayo Clinic too. And they had two sons, and they became very famous, and so did father. So with persistence, he created a place to operate if people could come to him. There was sometimes a small battle as to whether people should come to him or somewhere else, but he had a reputation for being successful and not having a high death rate. And then there was a convent that was nearby, and he needed a hospital, and the convent was mainly interested in teaching, but could they take on nursing responsibilities? That was a possibility. The woman in charge, the Mother Superior, was willing to give that a go, and it was successful, so people would come and they would have operating rooms, and the women were the assistants, and sometimes when the doctors were out of town, the women got to be able to do things that were rather serious but very helpful, they got to expand this convent, and they were in behind that there were the Mayo people who were Protestant in background, but they were quite willing and interested to work with the Catholic population. But some of the population that was being served was not sure about this sort of relationship, but they also knew that the success rate was there. If it was a broken bone, the broken bone was likely to repair itself. And so that Father got to be knowledgeable, and he would go off to other places in Europe and England and learn how to do new procedures, which were very rare for the West, where people were heading west, but they weren't in the time frame to build hospitals and have doctors and well health. If you made a mistake with your axe and hurt a leg, you may just have to have the leg amputated with gangrene, and that's not an easy thing if you didn't have ether or chloroform. But, so the doctor's wife got to be the person who administered the chloroform, and chloroform was slower but better than ether, and she got to know what the details were, and she got to know when people were coming out of anesthesia, and so it was interesting to see that these were women who were not just at home or secretaries or school teachers, or they weren't categorized for what they do. And they did things very well, and they expanded, and they expanded again. And then the Royal Opposition came in with a different hospital, which was more Protestant style. but the people still went to the Mayo elder. Well, then came the two boys. There were the girls too, and both seemed to be involved to some extent, but the two boys were destined to be future doctors. And even at the early age of teenaging, they were helping to assist in operations, and they got to be very knowledgeable. One was older and more bookish, but also able to present their case for doing things. And he would go to meetings, and his younger brother was equally involved in discovering different types of operations. And he was more folksy. He was able to talk his way through things that he didn't know about, but thought they ought to experiment with. And their survival rate was high, and higher than the people who were around. So the population grew, and the elder son went off to a medical school. There weren't too many medical schools. They hadn't got to the point of teaching people. And later, Charles went off to medical school too. But these young doctors would go to meetings, and they were knowledgeable, and they could, with good manners, comment on a paper that was presented at a meeting, and to good effect. Say, it might be that people thought that cancer was contagious, but they would point out that older people get cancer, and you're dealing with younger people in the settlement era, so very little cancer. But as the era got older and the people got older, there was more cancer. So the appearance of cancer wasn't because of a contagion, it was because the aging process was there. And that sort of commentary had to be delivered very carefully, because otherwise they would have been oscillated, sort of insisted, because they were not doing things according to the traditions. And so they too, as young doctors, went off to Europe and to other places in the U.S. To watch operations. They weren't so interested in the theory of it as they were in actually watching operations. And when they came back to the U.S. with knowledge, they would allow people to come and visit. If they were in a meeting and it was thought that they were couldn't possibly have 100 examples of where they had operated, were using a certain technique, then there would be a comment that this was a very small community. It couldn't possibly have that many people operating for a gallbladder or a stomach problem. It would be so their paper would get rejected, or their it was not understood that some of the people who were watching the quality of the commentary by the young doctors and their father were interested in allowing or encouraging people to come see what they were doing. And people were somewhat amazed that these young people could actually take on other people's operational procedure, but improve upon it. And gradually their population of people increased. And it wasn't just for one or two particular operations, like stomach was a concern. And if you were going to take out part of the bowel, you had to have some way of connecting the two pieces so that they didn't get gangrene. The women were concerned because they would have tremendous cysts that needed to be removed, and somebody had to get game enough to be able to open up a body and remove the cyst. And believe it or not, these people survived and were very grateful. Sometimes it was not the stomach that was the problem. It might have been a gallbladder or an appendicitis. So how could they encourage this? Well, the elder son could speak very well, and he was eventually invited to meetings and was a member of meetings and actually chaired meetings. And he not only took their ideas, but he said very loudly and clearly that these weren't necessarily all their own ideas. These were the ideas where they had a string around several ideas, and their contribution was the string and the bow that brought these ideas together. So they were improving on it, and they could tell people, and people were realizing this. They sometimes had Nabob leading surgeons come and be amazed. So they would do operations and let people watch, and much more, they would allow for people to move in and actually see what was going on. It's very hard to have a body and have it open and have people see what's going on in minute detail. You can get an idea of the generality, but they would use mirrors, and they would have lights so that the people could see what was going on. They sometimes reduced the number of assistants that they had to perhaps one that was providing. The second son was several years younger than his brother, but they were very much doing things together. They would do the same operation together in unison, until it got to be that they had so many operations that they actually had to separate and do things themselves. But Charlie, the younger one, was the one that could work with the problem and experiment with it and open up the person and decide that it was not a problem of stomach, it was a problem that might involve other parts of the body. It had to be very delicate. If it was a goiter, or it had to involve blood vessels and nerves. The brain had to involve details that they didn't know about. And this was all in sort of makeshift studios or in homes. People would have you come to their home, and they would have to set up the kitchen table with that, not a lot of sterilization. That was an early problem. People would use instruments in a manner that they weren't clean. A pastor hadn't come on the field yet, and other thoughts of cleanliness were not there. But Father found out that if you had bleeding in an ulcerated area, you could take kerosene and put it on a swatch, and that would help to close up the bleeding vessels. And then you would wait a while and open up again. And so little things like that made it possible for others to learn. There were no real medical schools, and this was in the area where you had probably in the 1861, 2, 3, that area, where there were still Indian tribes in Minnesota, and they were assigned to reservations, and those reservations were not being provided with adequate food that was promised. The land had been taken over and weren't being looked after, so they were challenging the Caucasian invaders. That got to be a real challenge at the same time as there was a civil war and discussion about slavery. But gradually they solved those problems, and some of them were rather serious. You didn't know that your friends or relatives were going to be alive next day, because the Indians knew how to do guerrilla warfare and make a statement, and they deserve to be heard. So you have two individuals and a father operating very independently, moving across the country, and gradually the population of users expanding, the Catholic support hospital having to grow and do things that they had never done before. And there was some intermarrying here. The boys married people who were also very sympathetic, and perhaps had brothers who were headed for medicine. And gradually that got to be an in-house event, but almost too many people coming in, and almost too many doctors coming to observe. So they eventually decided that they should put together some sort of association, and that association should include other people, and they invited in other people, and they created a will and testament, which would mean that the organization would not fail if any one of them died. That took a lot of doing. It had to figure out who was going to own what operation, or who was going to be paid. They were very sure that they did not want to charge people who didn't have the money in a depression to pay them. So a lot of the services were free. And even after the success of an operation, they may be paying for the person to be living somewhere that could be close enough where he could be monitored. So they eventually had an organization with two or three, or not very many more, specialists. Some of the specialties that came into action were eyes. People had cataracts, and they needed to have cataracts removed. And Charlie became very good at doing that. But these weren't one-dimensional doctors. They might do that at one stage and then be removing something gross on a foot at another, or doing something with the intestine. They got to be somewhat specialized in intestines because they seem to do very well, and they found procedures that would allow the junction of intestines without the fear of gangrene. And they got to realize that sterility was an important thing, and their hospital, their rather crude laboratories were kept clean, and instead of washing the wound with water that might be contaminated, they drained that out in a more sensible fashion and didn't include a lot of loose possible bacterial infection. Eventually, they had to deal with people coming in. People did not always appreciate their knowledge. And as we said, Rochester was a small community, and how come they had so many experiences with operations, perhaps 100 in a community that normally wouldn't have that many of that type of operation to be engaged in? But it was because the outside was coming in, and in some cases they were going out to communities. So the next thing was to get the visiting professors, the visiting surgeons, to have a group of associates so that they could talk to each other. And not everyone wanted to do this, but it certainly brought the operational people together. And, so the Mayo people, just three of them, added to with about three others that were specialists that would be able to handle a microscope or special equipment and do diagnostic work. And they would want these people that came in to associate to also go out and work with people who needed them, but also with people who needed their ideas. And so gradually they set up new facilities that were larger. By the time they got built, they were almost too small. They may have a number of doctors coming to see the same operation. They would want to see several operations. So William would be doing one operation. Charles in the next operating room would be doing another. And before these visitors left, they may be looking at 30 or 40 different operations. And they were very glad to get that experience. And the hospital nearby was providing respite for these people, but they also wanted to have an area where they could come together after operations had been seen and talk the matters up, you know, whether it just be sociologically or professionally. So those sorts of friendly activities got expanded, gradually these three people got to be recognized at an regional level, and then like Chicago or Philadelphia or other places, including Europe. So people are traveling across the Atlantic to visit the Mayo Clinic. And the streets were still mud. The parks were small. And the Mayo team was getting to be paid enough by people who could afford it to upgrade the community with various services. First one was a telephone to be able to connect house to house. The two brothers had a house next door to each other, and they could communicate. They were going to have a telephone connection, but their wives said, no, we're not going to do this 24 hours a day. So they had a speaking tube. And you have to realize this was in the 1880s, 1890s. This is when my grandfather was still alive. It was in other countries it spread more slowly, but you had to have things like somebody had to provide ambulances. Well, I can remember early ambulances where they were like a modified 1928 Chevrolet. It was a buckboard, and you could get one patient in the back. This was early ambulances in Australia, and the community had to pay for that. This was not a national level thing, this was a local thing. And so I always remember ambulance drivers with their hands out at various venues to keep the ambulances alive. In the U.S., there was more entrepreneurial stimulus to create an ambulance so that they could take a patient from an operating theater to the hospital. That could be a professional thing. So these people were not only willing to explore, but they were willing to share, and they were willing to be involved with the community. And both brothers bounced off of each other. The elder brother was very sure that he wanted to make sure that the public knew that they were a pair, and that although Charles was more folksy and not out in front quite so much, he was also very essential in a totally different manner. He would, his discussion, his wife had him organized for a presentation that would be organized, and she would be in the audience and egg him on. But his problem was that he would get to a point and then he would think about a story, and he would break off into a story. And people would enjoy that, even as he was operating. But the wife was rather frustrated at that. But it was his forte, and he got to be recognized for this. And sometimes they would have many visiting scholars watching what he was doing, and he would try to tell them exactly what he was doing so that they could follow through. But when he got to a certain point and it meant that somebody else had some involvement here, perhaps success or failure, he would go into that story. And It was almost as if these people would want the operation to be repeated because there was so much information that they could not handle it all. So scholars would come back annually, and gradually the medical hospitals got to realize that they needed to have medical schools, and there was a problem of uneducated, unqualified people out there doing medical work without the appropriate credentials. Did these people become the teachers? Not exactly. They were teachers when they were demonstrating in an operating room, but not in the theory. So gradually there were societies put together, and there was some recognition given to this crazy bunch of three people who were prepared to spend their lives working at improving the health services and being very successful at it. So they were eventually getting accolades from people who realized the quality of their work, whereas some of the older population was not very certain about that, these were young people. They looked like teenagers. They were probably 20 or 23 or 21, but they were so much younger than the establishment, sometimes establishment. I couldn't quite follow that. But gradually, Mayo Clinic became a focus for the rest of the world. And people would come in regularly. Early on, it was by horse and buggy. Gradually, the trains came by, so you could come by train, and eventually biplanes. And gradually, by 1900, there was a flow of people coming in that was quite considerable. And this team was being given credentials, and they were able to be very successful in their speeches or in their operations, and in consideration for working with the communities, raising the level of medical awareness. It came in stages. At the outset, one of the real problems was problems with uterine growth that could be solved. It involved breast cancer. It involved the early stages of graft, skin graft, and the decision to take a breast off and replace it with a graft, rather than to have a rather diseased piece of breast that would not heal well. And gradually these things worked. And the stomach one came in because there were lots of problems with people thinking they had digestion, and trying to solve that with food or medicine, and didn't work. But sometimes it was a blockage of a alimentary canal and joining it together. And so there were periods when one thing was more important than another. There were periods when it was discovered that they could actually remove a cataract, and people would take their cataract home with them because they wanted to show others that they could now see when they were blind with cataract. There were ear, nose, and throat connections that gradually evolved. And so here were theoreticians that were claiming that they really weren't the instigators, but in fact they were bringing things together for other people to enjoy. They were kind of on the loner side. So the nurses and the wives and the children got to be involved some, and the two children lasted up into the late 1930s. And they, Mayo Clinic has continued with that sort of quality of bringing people to them. Sometimes they go out to people, so there was an input and an output. Sometimes it was total failure. If you went out and the diagnosis had been with a local level person, they had to appreciate that that was there, but when they opened up the person, the problem might be appendicitis and not the stomach. So you might not want to do that sort of operation right away, or but you had to be very careful not to hurt the original person that did the diagnosis. There were surgeons who were surgeons that would amputate a leg but were not knowledgeable about some of the body. So there was a need for an education of where the arteries were, where the nerves were. And it's interesting to think that this was only 100 years ago, and we've made progress. And there's still a lot to learn, and Mayo Clinic is a center for doing that. Sometimes locally, we think that some of the local clinics would like to think of themselves as a Mayo Clinic in this area. And that's justified to some extent, but it hasn't got that history and that structure and that energy that put together Mayo Clinic. And it's not in a major city, it's not in Chicago, it's not in St. Paul, it's not in Minneapolis, it's not in Wisconsin, but there are outliers of people who are now members of a team of people who have been to share this sort of information. And the Mayo family has been very humble in the way they have worked. This has not been a competition. This has been progress and experimentation and intelligence and dependent on people who are willing to work and also be dependent and independent in their work. The woman who was doing the wife who was doing the I think it was the one of the directors of the Catholic institution who getting to be so good at doing anesthesia that they were encouraged to go out. And so this is some of the first opportunities that women had to do much more than be at home and producing families. This was making excellent use of people's minds that didn't always get that chance. So I wanted to bring that together. I haven't finished reading the book yet because it finishes with the passing of the two brothers. And it's been repeated, edited. There are various editions for many years ahead. The woman that did it was selected by the University of Minnesota. Her name is Clap and Clap and Settle. It's an unusual name, but there's a story about it. The Mayo Clinic people would take people down the Mississippi for a sort of a business get together, and some of the university preacher or people approached these family and said the hosts and said, "We would like to make a history of your organization." And they said, "Well, we've been approached a lot of times to do that, but it seems to be a fairly rough, tough estimate of what we do, and we prefer not to do that." And the university chancellor said, "You have done enough that you don't really own your own history. This is something that is beyond you, and it should be recorded. And we think that if the university were to make a record of what you, your father and your brother and your family has done, this would be a contribution that's important, and we would guarantee it to be written properly." So the university appointed Helen Clap and Settle, and she wrote this starting about 1934, and she was allowed to interview the people. Sometimes they didn't interview modern employees, but eventually, when that it was an important part of development, they did that too. And the book that I'm reading is an abbreviation, and it's like 400-500 pages, and this is a summary because the book got to be rather popular and has had many reproductions. But there is still the original information. So if you are a historian and if you want to follow the Mayo family, you can do so in tomes that are probably too much for the general surgeon, the public, or even people who are organizing. There was an era when the railroads were very concerned about some of this. They were putting in railroads, but they were having accidents, and they had to have appointees who knew something about public health, and they had to have administrators who would bring together those people, and then there had to be governmental involvement to see that something correct was going on. And so all that had to be recorded, and I think that's worth reporting to your involvement. Just think of the parallels with natural history and the things that we talk about that are environmental. I think we're getting to the end of the program. I thank you for listening. Think about what you do with your mind and action, and it can be very small, but it can be quite significant. So onward and upward. This is Dave Montgomery, WAFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial. And think about WEFT as one of those agencies that in 40 years has survived and brings you information, especially about community affairs and music, that where experts come in and they know their onions and can tell you and give you an excitement about music that's not always available on other broadcast medium. Thank you.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Minuteman Press. Whether you need signs for an event, thousands of full-color flyers, or personalized promotional items, Minuteman Press can make it happen in time and on budget. They offer an extensive line of products as well as design services. Minuteman Press may be reached online at cuprinting.com, in person at 905 South Neal Street in Champaign, or by calling 217-355-0500.
It's WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM.